I mean, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But
the important thing is to do your reading, and we can kind of relax that as we get into, if we get into a pattern where that's understood and people are doing reading, we have a high level of reading saturation. But now we have kind of a goal of looking at some of the first writing that's been done from you guys in the other section, and you know, starting a process of really learning together what counts as good philosophy writing, right? And especially good philosophy writing on happiness, right? So now we're in a position to make a little progress on that. So I want to put up the document that I just sent you guys earlier today, and just kind of look at a couple of the comments on a couple of the groups. I gave everybody 4 points, as you know, but the truth is, they weren't all equal. It's just hard to penalize groups for a writing project, you know, because who knows what happened in the group, right? You know, so the point, but group writing is kind of a nice exercise to look at some first writing, because we can give everybody the points, and we can just kind of be disinterested and kind of look at it and say, okay, what's good? Which are the better answers, and what do I need to notice about the better answers so that when I write my answers and do my philosophy, it's good. It's the best philosophy I can do. Right. Okay. So if there's no other, let me call the roll before we do that. I haven't been bringing the roll, and I need to learn more names. Emma. Hi. Jillian.
Here.
Shannon. Great. Aaron.
Good.
Ryan.
Good.
Colton is not here. Harry. Great. Julia. Great. TJ? Kimberly?
Here.
Elizabeth's over there. Nathan?
Here.
Hi. Gus?
Yep.
Good. Joseph? Joey?
Yeah. Here.
Matthew?
Here.
Paul? Great. Cassidy?
Here.
Good. Matthew Mortimer?
Here.
Right. Good. Jack?
Here.
Good. Hala? Where's Hala? Lauren's over there. I saw her. Alana? Right. Nicole? Good. And Hannah?
Did you say Anna or Hannah?
Hannah.
Then, no.
Okay.
Sorry.
Anna.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's just take a look at this writing together, if you guys can. I don't know how this happened here. This is not going away. It's very annoying. Very sticky. Anyway. So do you just do this? You have to move it. There we go. Okay, so let's just look at a couple of these together. Do you guys remember the question? Let's just get the question back. So the question was, why are so many people in the culture focused on raising their kids like Bob when it looks like Mary has more of the components of happiness? I want to leave this from our previous class, but just squeeze this in here. So if you're asked a why question, you know, there's a good chance that what's being asked of you is to provide an explanation. Sometimes why questions demand arguments, and some of the groups did write some arguments. But the one thing that distinguished the better answers from the worst answers is that the better answers actually answered the question or tried to answer the question. It wasn't a difficult question. Most of the good answers said similar things, so it wasn't like it wasn't like there was a kind of esoteric answer. So one thing to look at when you're looking at this kind of writing is it really addressing what it set out to do? And I didn't think this first one really did. Another thing I'm really focused on, and I'd like you to also focus on, is this characteristic of good writing called flow. This is not the same concept as flow that we're going to study later in the term. This is a really more of a technical concept, so if you could just take a note on this, on what flow in writing is. Flow in writing is the characteristic of sentences logically and coherently following one another. Flow is that characteristic. And for my money, it's one of the biggest predictors of, one of the best ways to distinguish relatively better and worse upper-level college writing. You know. So when I see abrupt transitions in the course of the flow, I'll put these little slash marks. And so one way to think about this is, to be a good writer, you have to take care of your reader. And what your reader is doing is going from sentence to sentence. And readers have expectations. I mean, just think about when you're reading, the psychology, it's easier to read a piece if your expectations aren't abruptly frustrated, right? So when you go from one sentence to another and the topics are similar and there's a development, your expectations aren't frustrated, right? So that's a better reading experience, but it's also likely to be a more coherent thought behind the writing, right? So it's not just psychologically easier for the reader. So take care of your reader. Put that in your notes. Take care of your reader. That's a mantra in good writing. Another concept of good writing that I'll just point out is this idea of curse of knowledge. A really famous thinker, Steven Pinker, who wrote a book on style recently, and he said the single biggest problem in writing well is the curse of knowledge. So let me tell you what it is. The curse of knowledge is the curse that writers have that they know what they're trying to say, and so they tend to think their words are saying it. Did you get that in your notes somehow? The curse of knowledge is the tendency to think that your words are actually conveying meaning to someone else because you're so close to the meaning. You say it a couple different ways. So you have to really you have to always remind yourself as a writer that the reader isn't in your head. The reader's over there. They don't have access to the contents of your mind. And that's one of the reasons you have to spell things out. You have to have good flow. Okay, so I'm not going to say much more about writing today. If you guys have comments or questions, please bring them in. But what I'd like you to do is see if you agree with me on these comments. Do you agree that the ones that flow, that I say flow well, really did? Are you able to see that characteristic in the writing? Now on content, the two main content answers were to focus on culture as a factor in why we do this. That, you know, we have a dominant, some of the answers said we have a dominant culture that's materialistic, individualistic, focused on achievement. That's a good answer, right? Can we turn the nonverbal up? Okay, thanks. Thank you. That's much better. Another kind of answer you gave was, you know, the problem of happiness looks different from a parent's perspective than a child's. That was a pretty insightful answer, actually. I really liked that. I hadn't really thought about that so much. So parents can't control things like long-term chronic health of their kids, but they can kind of help get their kids into a nice income bracket because financial security is meaningful. And some of you were skeptical of the idea that that wouldn't be a happiness maker, you know. So we're going to read more about that. So those were the kind of content dimensions of the answer. And all the good answers had at least one of those two main content ideas. This answer didn't get the adaptation principle right, so we're still, you know, it's okay, it was new material. This answer was kind of a process answer, let's call it. Like, here's what we said in the group. Okay, you see the point? That's okay. I mean, that was a report of what your group did. I mean, it's not an unreasonable way to interpret. But it doesn't read like an answer to a question. So that's the kind of, we definitely want to make sure that when we do our deliberate writing together, when you do your deliberate writing on a small question or a big question like, what is my theory of happiness, that that you really feel, that as a reader, that your readers really feel you're addressing the question that you set out to address, that you're not just rambling, you're not just saying what happened in your head when you thought about this problem or what happened in the group. Again, not an unreasonable interpretation of the task, but let's kind of get on the same page as far as responding to prompts and so on. Okay. There's a little bit more recap in here than needed for the question. I mean, the question, it is true that sometimes when you address a question in philosophy, you need to recap the material from a source, right? So I'm not saying you should never do that, but this question didn't require all the repetition of those details in the middle. I don't know which one is which. I've forgotten which groups are which here, so I don't know if I'm talking about this class or not. This one's a bit confusing. So because this one started with a big reason that Bob is more likely the happier individual. You see how that's, wow, really? Okay. Because in the problem, right, height shows all those attributes of Mary because there's research that says Mary's more likely to be happy. So you see how surprised I was when I read the first line of this? Now, that's okay. You can, remember I said you can challenge the assumptions in the question. So maybe this group is kind of saying, oh, we're not sure Bob isn't happier. That's okay. In philosophy, you can go a lot of different directions, but it would have been better to show that that's what you were doing. Our group thought maybe Bob would be happy. Great. This is philosophy. You can go a lot of different directions. But it helps to show that that's what you're, that you know that that's what you're doing, right? Okay, good flow here, and again, so I picked out, you know, did the text answer the question? Was it well written? Okay, so that's, I don't know if we need to do much more with this. And again, it's a good occasion to point it out because it's not anybody's writing, it's group writing. Okay. Anything else? Anything on that? Do you feel like we can start to calibrate our intuitions? The next step is to really do a piece of writing where we're looking together at this assignment rubric. I won't spend time on it now, but it's on the wiki there. It's there for you, and so as you can tell, it highlights features of good writing, features of a good answer from a content perspective, features of a good answer from a logic perspective, and then the icing on the cake, the thing we're really always trying for, don't always get in philosophy, is can you produce an insight? And in your answers to this exercise, I thought there was an insight, and I'll just mention it. To me, there was an insight. There might have been three others that I missed. And it's the insight that the problem of happiness is more complicated across generations, right? You guys got me thinking by your answers about just how different a parent's strategy for their kid's happiness has to be in some respects than a kid's strategy for their own happiness. Right? Because parents can't control some things. They can control other things. They can influence some things and not other things. And I thought that was kind of interesting. You know? Like with my kids, I've got two kids, two grown men. The youngest just graduated from college in May. And they're different. You know, one is a computer engineer. As you know, I mean, that's a very secure employment path, right? He can quit his job today and get another one tomorrow. The other one is a photography cultural studies major, you know, and so more of an art student. And his path is more like mine was when I graduated with a philosophy degree, you know. I started painting houses. It's like I was well qualified for painting houses. And so he's, you know, he got a wage job in a restaurant that makes really good meat pies. He's pretty excited about that job. And I worked in my share of restaurants too. So as a parent, I know my parents kind of anguished at the fact that I studied philosophy, right? So you see the topic? It's parents tend to strategically want different things for their kids' happiness than kids necessarily do, or young adults. So interesting insight. That's good. Okay. If you're saying thoughts on that, feel free to say something. Otherwise, we can get to our work. We have a lot of really interesting stuff to talk about today. Okay? So, let's start with the Hebron, if we could. And let's go ahead and... okay. And if you're not actively taking notes or doing something, then put down your phone, put down your laptop, you know, maybe even lower the lids so that you can kind of focus with us. Just kind of stay focused with us together, because that's really important. Okay. What Hebron's trying to do here is give you an analysis of emotional state happiness. So let's start our notes there. He's giving you an overview of his theory of happiness, just like Haidt did. But notice Haidt's was, what's the major research on happiness? What does it tell us about what happiness is? What Hebron's trying to do is define happiness as an emotional state. And remember, we had this picture, just to give you the contrast. Remember, this is going to be Hebron's theory, and this is going to be a different theory, right? So if you think happiness is composite, if it's comprised of emotional states and life satisfaction, then this is kind of your theory. we talked about how Haber wants to focus just on state happiness, which is a legitimate choice to make as a philosopher. So let's see what he says. And here was what I like. What he's doing is he wants to give you a vocabulary for talking about different emotional states. So he divides them into endorsement. Let's jot down something about each of these: endorsement, engagement, and attunement. So let's think about what each of these is. This is only the second year I've taught this text, and I found endorsement a really hard concept to understand, but I think I made some progress this year on it. So let me tell you what I think it means, and you guys tell me if you have some adjustments to make. Endorsement isn't a judgment, it's a feeling that you get from satisfying some criteria you accept as counting toward the claim, my life is positively good. So let's see if we can unpack that. Okay, maybe I can try to give you a feeling of the emotional state of endorsement. Can I do that? Let me give it a shot. Suppose I were to say to you, which I really believe from the bottom of my heart, you're all doing a really good job. Great, thanks. Thanks for your work today. Thanks for paying attention today. Did you get the feeling? A little bit? Nothing? Some of you, I saw some smiles. No, nothing? Okay.
I'm not the right person, maybe. Maybe under the right conditions, the right person could give you the feeling of emotional state of endorsement.
Anybody? Endorsement can be a feeling you get from getting your status validated, right? Yeah, I'm doing an okay job. So it can be literally an endorsement. I want to express my gratitude for your work. But it can also come from, he says it can also be a parent seeing their contented sleeping children. Or I'll add this example. You go home and your fridge is full of great food. So it doesn't have to be an evaluative, it doesn't have to be a feeling that you get from an evaluative endorsement, which is what I just tried to do with you. I tried to give you an evaluative claim that gave you a feeling, hopefully, of some pleasure. It could be just evidence in your life that your life is going well. And having food in the fridge isn't such a bad place to start. clean laundry, food in the fridge, you see what I'm saying? Right? So they could be, but the key thing is it's not judgments, because remember, judgments about your life have to do with life satisfaction. And Habermas's theory, make sure this is in your notes, Habermas's theory is really that happiness is fundamentally an emotional state, a range of emotional states, a set of emotional states. So what confused me about endorsement is that it seemed like it was bringing in judgments about my life, but it's really more bringing in experiences that give me the feeling that my life is going well. So getting a good grade on a test is an endorsement. Right? You could use it as the basis of a judgment that you're in the right major, right? That you're studying the right thing, that you're doing well. You could use it for that judgment, but you could just focus on the feeling. What's the feeling when you get that test back and it's okay or great? Right? You know that feeling? It's like, hey, I'm okay. So you do get that feeling
every once in a while.
Not from me, apparently. Yeah. Okay. So you see where we're going? It's the feeling that you get from feedback from others or evidence in your life that you're in the right place, things are going well, you have a truly positively good life. Okay, engagement is a bit different. Engagement is really composed of, he says it's composed of two things. One is a kind of vitality, that you have a kind of vigor and an eagerness to be engaged in your life. And for most of you, the way to experience this is if you've ever been a little bit blue, right? So some of you have experienced a little sadness, maybe it's not depression in a clinical sense, but that loss of motivation, sometimes it comes when you get sick. Have you guys experienced it when you get like a flu? All of a sudden, you're not so interested in all these things that you're supposed to be doing, right? Flow, we're going to study later. He mentions, again, the book that we're going to read from Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi. So we'll talk about that. But that flow is a state of emotional engagement in which you are. I'll repeat it from last time, right? Where you're completely immersed in an experience that's just at the edge of your skill challenge level. So it demands all your experience. A competitive game, a difficult philosophy text. There's just nothing better, right? So flow is a kind of engagement. It's a kind of emotional happiness from engagement. Okay, attunement. Now, here we go back to the Haidt article. Remember, in the Haidt article, he was skeptical about investing too much in internal strategies. Remember that internal versus external strategy distinction? A little more nonverbal, please. Right, good, okay. Because he indicated that, you know, some historical examples of the internal strategy involve withdrawal from life, right? Remember the desert fathers who got up on pedestals, withdrew from life, ascetics, people who practice intensive meditation practices. But is that true? I mean, is it true that... it is true that there are historical examples of people who choose radical internal strategies, right, which lead them to withdraw from life. So that would be a tension between attunement and engagement. But I don't think it's true that internal strategies have to take you out of your life. Let's think about that together. Where are you guys on this? Can you have the third characteristic, peace, attunement, peace of mind, tranquility, confidence, expansiveness? Can you pursue, those are pretty much products of internal strategies. I mean, you may have those already by nature. You might just be a really tranquil person. But when we look at the happiness practica that are coming up, right? If you choose any of those would be occasions where you would choose an activity that might increase your sense of attunement. What do you guys think? Is attunement at odds with engagement? Yeah, please.
It's kind of like having a conversation instead of talk, it's time to listen.
Say again?
Like, if you're having a conversation,
yeah.
Time to talk, it's time to listen. So,
yeah.
Like, attunement's like listening to yourself.
Ah,
what's
interesting.
Going on in there.
Right.
Engagement's like just talking, doing
right.
What you're doing.
Right, right. So they really refer to different phases, different modes of existence that I might be in, right? Or I might be, attunement really... I like that, you know. They're not at odds because they really refer to different, would you say, phases of your activity? Or,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good. Yeah, please.
I think they can exist at the same time. You look at confidence as a word to define attunement, and when you talk about flow or getting into the zone while doing something,
mm-hmm.
That takes the level of confidence in your abilities. Yes, you're being challenged, but
right.
It's affirming. Because oftentimes there are small successes that lead to overall completion. So yes, you can get the confidence, you know, big bang at the end of what you're doing, but I think you can get it as you do it.
Good,
so
I like that.
Engage and attune.
So you notice that's a different strategy for saying that they're compatible. I take your point to imply that you actually might need one for the other. So you might need attunement to experience flow, because if you're too anxious about what you're going to have for dinner or whether someone likes you, you know, you're not going to be able to immerse yourself in this activity that really demands all your attention. So yeah, attunement can actually enhance... Oh, I'm sorry, I just noticed you have an injury. It's okay? Okay, sorry. So attunement can actually enhance engagement. That's good. Those are two different answers that both kind of really get at the issue. Good. Okay, other thoughts on this? Okay, I don't need to do too much of this rest the last part of the chapter, but there's some important stuff in there. I think that's most of what I needed to get out of this. We're gonna engage this question about how universal this is. Just at this point, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but. Do you think Habermann's describing emotional states that basically everybody in every culture experiences, or are you skeptical of that? We're not going to be able to answer the question, interestingly, until we read some research on cross-cultural differences in happiness. There really are a lot. But it doesn't necessarily mean that these are cross-cultural. These are not trans-cultural. So do you have a hunch about whether... everybody experiences these emotional states? Do people in different cultures experience them differently? Are they? What's your hunch?
Until I know, going from Descartes, until I know
right.
that all the cultures are in every experience, which
right.
I
no.
I can't.
I don't need to know them all. You just need to know a few. I mean, you can't confirm...
That's versus absolute knowledge. Versus
right, yeah, you can't confirm that it's absolutely universal unless you know all, but you might disconfirm that it's universal just by finding two that are different. Yeah, do you have a hunch? Anybody? Yeah.
Well, I think that maybe they value them differently. So, like, I spent a semester in Florence, and so I was trying to compare, like, what Italians would think.
Good.
And I feel like maybe from what I saw when I went and hung out with, like, an Italian family, they're more into, like, the endorsement of, like, the little things, like, hanging out with your family, like, drinking the dessert wine, like,
good.
Getting some gelato. I mean, like,
good.
That's just what from what I saw, but, like,
good.
I couldn't quite see the engagement because... I mean, they do push their skill set, but it's kind of like my family's all architects and we live in Florence, so I'm an architect who lives in Florence, and I mean, sure, they have their own edge to that, but I don't know if that's what I would see.
Yeah, your hunch is that culture, from your experience, really, which is a hunch, is that different things might count as endorsement.
Yeah.
There might be different styles of engagement. But these seem like things you would expect to find in different forms, maybe in lots of places.
Yeah, but I think they would pick one over others.
Right, and then you could say, well, different cultures might foreground.
Yeah.
Right. Very good. You're on the right. I think you're definitely on the right track in terms of the research that we're going to read soon. Yeah.
I was going to agree with you and say I think he mentioned it even in the chapter that Asians tend to focus more on attunement,
mm-hmm.
and it definitely means something different than.
Mm-hmm.
Especially tranquility and peace of mind,
right.
It definitely means something else to them than it does to Americans.
Right. We're going to get a lot of information that confirms what you just said, and we're going to get other information that suggests that different cultures tolerate positive and negative affect in different ways. So it's okay to express different kinds of emotions in different situations in different cultures. So yeah, I mean, I think you should have a hunch that I'd be surprised if I met a human being who didn't understand this language, this vocabulary in their own language. But I wouldn't be surprised to find different weights put on it and different priorities and different things satisfying. Right. Good. Okay. Anybody else? Good. Okay. Good. I think that's what we needed from Hayden. So that's again. It's mostly like vocabulary for thinking about. State happiness in maybe more depth or more of the structure of it. Okay, so let's get to our research chapter here, and this is kind of neat because this is one of our first chapters where we're getting a fair number of studies. So if I could just ask you in your notes to kind of make a little box around this advice I'm going to give you. I want to give you like a four-step method for reporting research findings. And for those of you who come out of science or social science, this is going to be really pretty good. Redundant, but the first would be the focus of the study. The second would be what was done. So I'll illustrate this with an example from the Gilbert chapter. So, and this would include if it's an experimental study, this would include experimental conditions. If it's a survey study, it would include, what was the content of the survey, who was it given to, right? So those are slightly different. And then the immediate results are the empirical results of the study. But I want to make sure that you also report the significance or purported significance, right? So there's a little four-step checklist to keep in mind when you're writing about material in the course. It's not going to be unusual for you to refer to studies. I want to make sure that you have them marked in your notes so that you can come back to them and find them when they're relevant to answers in the course. So, for example, let's get into the chapter a little bit, and then we'll illustrate this four-step process. So So the chapter actually starts with Laurie and Reba, right? But he doesn't get back to them until later. But he sets up this question. He sets up the question of whether twins who are conjoined, physically conjoined, could possibly be happy together. Now, there's evidence, you get this right at the beginning of the chapter, there's evidence that, in fact, conjoined twins want to stay together. They don't want to be separated. So the point for your notes is this. He's starting with a kind of hard-to-explain discrepancy. How could, put it in your notes this way, how could R and L be happy, given that we couldn't imagine being happy that way? Right? So how could R and L be happy, given that we couldn't imagine being happy that way? And it just gets, the problem gets worse when you read that there's empirical literature that says that overwhelmingly conjoined twins seem to be prefer to stay together. Okay? So that's a discrepancy in judgment about happiness. So instead of getting right to that, he's going to give you a bunch of studies that should prompt some skepticism. So let's take a look at some of the studies. So the puzzle about R&L kind of raises the question about how good we are at comparing experiences, right? After all, if we're going to compare Laurie and Reba's experience to our experience, we think we're able to do that, right? But are we really good at comparing two instances of our own experience? Well, some studies suggest we're not so good at it. So put the question in your notes. Are we good at comparing experiences? And the first study I'll mention is a study about, so this is a study about whether people can remember colors that they saw, first step, right? In this study, some test subjects were given, all test subjects were given swatches of yellow. In one test condition, right, notice I'm talking about experimental conditions here, in one test condition, subjects were asked to describe their color, and in another test condition, subjects were just asked to experience the color. Then test subjects were asked to compare what they saw to a new color swatch, to see if it's the same, see if they can tell the same. The immediate result of this study was that people weren't very good at identifying the same color, and describers were worse at it, right? The significance of the study, what's the significance of the study? Anybody?
You want to
give it a shot.
As you describe something, you're assigning feelings towards it that start to morph your later perception.
Yeah.
Memory.
Good. So the significance would be trying to explain the results, right? So one way to explain the significance is to say, well, this shows the effect of cognition on memory, that it has a distorting effect. Okay. See, so I would like you to kind of try to practice this when you're recalling studies in your writing or speaking. So this is I don't know how robust a result this is. If it's really robust, then it would be like saying that we couldn't compare the happiness we got from having dinner with a friend yesterday to the happiness we have with our dinner today. That we might mistake the experience of engagement and vitality with the experience of attunement. Well, I don't know. Color swatch, put it in your notes this way. Color swatches are simple experiences. Happiness comparisons seem to be more complex. I don't know if that argues in favor of them not being consistent with the results of the color swatch studies or being consistent. You could say, I wouldn't mistake attunement for vitality. I might not be able to pick out the same yellow. You see where I'm going with this? So maybe color swatches aren't a good proxy for judgments about happiness. Maybe they are. The point is that Gilbert, get this in your nose, the point is Gilbert is raising skeptical doubts about our ability to make basic comparisons in our experience. And after all, if I can't do that, how the heck am I going to steer my happiness boat to the safe shore? You know, how am I going to get there? How big a problem this is, I don't know. But here's the theoretical statement of the problem in a nutshell. When you compare two experiences, at least one of them is a memory, right? They're usually both memories. Because usually you're comparing two experiences after you've had both of them. But let's say you're in one experience, you're having birthday cake, and you're trying to compare it to the birthday cake you had last year to see if this is a better birthday cake. That's a year ago, right? A lot of things have come, that memory has been altered by being remembered, by being put in juxtaposition with experiences over the last 365 days, right? So it's plausible that you can't make a good comparative judgment like that. That's a problem for happiness. And so the larger, so let's expand the problem. How aware are you of what's going on in your environment? So attentional, put in your notes, attentional focus studies are relevant to Gilbert's skepticism, right? If he wants to make you a skeptic about happiness, he's about judging happiness, he might point out this research about how bad we are at paying attention to really basic things in our environment. I always thought I was bad at this because I was a philosopher. But how many of you have noticed that you've sometimes mistaken really big things in your environment? Elizabeth, this comes easy. Yep, that's me. So let's look at a couple of experiments that he was referring to. One that he was referring to from Daniel Simon's lab. And if you've seen this, don't give it away. But if you haven't, try to pay attention to it so that you can kind of get into it. And the first one, you're just going to see an illustration of a study. And I should It's a little soft. The volume's a little soft. Can I just ask
for Pride's differentials? The young man on the left is one of the experimentals. He is approached by one pair of man and asked for directions. After a close up, two people carrying a door pass between them, and the first experimenter is replaced by someone else.
Did you get it? Did you see it? That would be so me.
Like many people in the study, the pedestrian was entirely unaware that he was talking to a different person.
Right. How many times have you had similar experiences? Like
approximately 50% of the people approached in this study didn't notice when the person they were talking to was replaced by someone
else. Really bad. I mean, it's really bad. Sometimes I've been talking to
first to demonstrate
yeah, sorry,
that change blindness. Can occur outside of the laboratory. This video is from research by Daniel Simons and Daniel Levin and is copyrighted.
Yeah. Had some of you seen that before? Some of the psych students maybe? Yeah, okay, good. I've had experiences where, you know, I've been talking to someone and then a few hours later I couldn't remember what they looked like even. It was just like I was having a conversation. I was distracted. I was doing something else at the same time. So when we multitask, often attentional focus drops out. We tend to think our minds are like video recorders. They're not. Okay, I'm going to tell you the news today. They're not. Okay, and that's a good thing because you literally wouldn't have had room to put it all up there anyway. Okay, so watch this one. See if you can focus on this one.
This is a test of selective attention. Count how many times the players where and what pass the basketball.
Okay, so that's kind of his point in the first part of the. Now the second part of the chapter leads us to a small group experience, which I'm really hopeful for you guys. I want to hear some interesting work coming out of it. So let me set it up as quickly and efficiently as I can. And you guys have the advantage of us having done this last hour. So he wants to work on this problem of skepticism by giving you a pretty elaborate contrast between two possibilities regarding the twins. So for this contrast, you have to assume that Reba and Laurie have limited experience. And just take that as a given in this, because you could argue, well, maybe they don't. And that you do have lots of experience. You have exotic experience, you have peak experience, you've traveled, you've tasted good wine, that sort of thing. Okay. So the question he wants to ask is, if you and the twins share a birthday cake, I'm going to encourage you to draw this in your notes, so just take a minute and start drawing. I'm just going to give you a minute to draw it in there. So you notice, you remember this from the reading, you've got the 1 to 8 scale, that's our language. Put your happy faces in. Sad faces.
Just draw it out, it's kind of complicated. Okay, getting there, good, take your time.
Make sure you label this one language squishing. This one is experience stretching. Okay. So, what we want to do is ask the question, when people with different levels or backgrounds of experience have the same experience, how do we know if they're having the same experience and talking about it differently, or if they're having different experiences and maybe talking about it differently? Right? How do you know? So I'll say that again. When you're comparing experiences with people with different backgrounds of experience, how do you know that they're having the same experience and maybe talking about it differently? Versus having different experiences and talking about it differently.
Okay, it's a little complicated, but let's see if you can stay on it. It helps to have the diagram, I think.
All right, so in the first case, language squishing says that we're really having the same experience of the birthday cake as Reba and Lori, but what they're doing is they're squishing their language for talking about it because they don't have a high range of experience. So they're having the same experience as us. That means they're getting the same hedonic feels, the same emotional states from the icing, the cake, you know, all the parts of the birthday cake, right? The flavors, you know, you've had your birthday cakes, right? They're having the same experience hedonically, but they're saying, wow, this is amazing. We don't get out that much. This is an 8. Right? You hear it? Other possibility, and notice, okay, we'll talk about the implications in a minute. Another possibility is that when you and the twins share the birthday cake, they're actually having a different experience. You've had a lot of experiences. You've eaten great birthday cakes. This is a 5, maybe. But again, their limited background experience might make it so that their experience of a mundane birthday cake is really a different experience. They don't just, in both cases, they give it an 8, but in this case, they're actually having a different experience. That's why the 8's kind of written up here. Does that make sense? Is that the 8's really a peak happiness experience? So what's happening when two people have an experience of something that causes happiness? Does the background experience of the people change the experience they're having, or does it just change the way they talk about the experience? Right? So let's go through it one more time, and then we're going to get you in groups. I'm going to kind of point out some of the implications. So if language squishing is what's happening, and we're having the same experience, but we're talking about it differently, then having peak experiences may not matter so much to your happiness, right? You've been around the world, you've tasted great birthday cakes, but you know, at the end of the day, you're having the same experience as the twins. You see the point? But if experience stretching is what's happening, then it's possible, it doesn't necessarily follow, but it's possible that you could be ruined by your peak experience. You know, this is not a great birthday cake. You know, I've had better. In fact, if you have really rich experience, maybe you have a great birthday cake every week. And all of a sudden, this one comes along. It's like, wow, Safeway cake? Give me a break. You know? So what we want to know is, can we tell what's going on, first of all? And can we make any inferences about the experiences and the effects of this on our potential happiness? So can you find some questions to consider in your group? Can you find peak happiness in mundane experience? Can you be ruined by rich or exotic experience? Does happiness require peak experiences? Does our experience change our relationship to happiness? If you've experienced the Northwest's explosion in gastronomy of beer, can you go back to PBR? This is the question for the day, right? I'm done with PBR. I haven't had a PBR in a long time. I would rather not have a beer than have a PBR. Now, some of you are not in that place. You know, some of you are like, a PBR works pretty well. Some of you are buying box wine still, okay? You know, I don't know. I'm not having box wine. Now, what I need you to do, you see where we're going. Now, in group, what I need you to do is think about whether and how your experience changes your experience of successive happiness events, or how it changes the way you talk about them. So can you be ruined by your experience? But can you get in groups and give this some work? We've got plenty of time. We're up to this 5 to 7 minutes. It should be a really good discussion. Try to bring something back from the group to our whole discussion, okay? So you can use these questions. There's also some questions on the class.
Yeah.
I win, I like lost 50 bucks, and then I went again and like lost 20, and I was just, and even if I like won 20, I was like, this sucks. Like, yeah,
good.
I could almost win anything except that, and I'd be like, this is awful.
So you could have an experience that, how would you describe that? Yeah.
I would just say like because it was such a like, it was the very first experience, and it was so overwhelmingly positive that it sort of gives you the false impression that it should be like that.
Right.
That's kind of similar to this. Like, if you had a really great cake, and that was, like, your first cake you had, then any other cake after that, you sort of expect them to be like that.
Yeah. So you could be spoiled in the sense that you could have your expectations altered. Hey, I think, Elizabeth, we're coming back to porn here, I think. You could be spoiled because you could have your expectations so distorted going forward that you then can't achieve satisfaction, as it were. Right. Okay, yeah, good. One data point I'd bring in here is, move us in another direction, is, you know, I think it's intriguing to ask whether you need peak experience. Going into it, I don't like this phrase bucket list at all, really, but, you know, the concept of a bucket list is the idea that you can predict now that you really will be happier if you do certain things in your life, right? Maybe not, right? Does the bucket list make any sense if you're going to basically squish your language to your experience? Maybe peak experiences don't matter that much. One place to look is people who have been through the Depression. Now, it just so happened that, you know, my new hospice patient is a 95-year-old woman. I don't know if I mentioned that to you. And so this week, she was telling me a really interesting story that kind of relates to this. So experiences of people from the Depression might be relevant to this as data points, you know. And so here's what she said. It's a really interesting story. She's 95 years old, so she was a kid during the Depression, right? She was a teenager. And so finally I was like, oh, that's right, you grew up during the Depression. And what was that like? And she said, no money. Nobody had any money. And she kept saying it that way. It was like she'd been saying it all her life. There was no money. And I said, oh, so what did you do? And I said, well, we couldn't do much because there was no money. And she kept saying over again, nobody had any money. And I'm like taking this in, I'm like, what would that even be like? No money? Like none? And she said, no, there was no money. So she said, I graduated from eighth grade. No, she said, well, it's not completely true. I graduated from eighth grade, they had plenty to eat. They were living on a farm. It was like, we had food security, but no money. And she said, well, she graduated from eighth grade in the Depression, and her grandmother gave her 50 cents. And it was like, oh, my God, you had 50 cents, Grandma? I thought nobody had any money. So she and her sister took the 50 cents and they bought a primer level piano instruction book. Because they had a piano in the house, but there was no money to tune it. It was out of tune. And so they get this 50 cents. You know, a movie is a nickel. I said, couldn't you go to the movies? Didn't the movie just cost like, a movie was just a few pennies. There was no money. So they bought this piano, self-instruction piano book, and she started talking about what an incredibly good time they had with this. They would do this every day in the afternoon after school. They would sit at the piano and they would teach themselves how to play piano. And then the parents came up with some money to buy a magazine subscription, so that some music magazine came every month. And she would describe what it was like to wait for the magazine to come. And when the magazine came, that was an incredible day. It was like one of the best days of the month. And the magazine had new music to play. So they had something to do for the next month. They could learn the new pieces in the... So when she describes that, she doesn't say... And by the way, I'm going to ask her next week some follow-up questions now that I'm using her experience in class. She implied that they made the best of it, that it was really a happy thing. But she didn't say that those were the happiest days of her life. You see what I'm saying? You see where I'm going? So she kind of proved both points. You don't necessarily have to have peak experience to be happy. You can squish your language. But that doesn't mean that you wouldn't be happier if you could have peak experiences. That sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Right? There's definitely a tension there. It might not be a contradiction because it might refer to two different scenarios. So in the scenario when I have limited experience, it's a wonderful thing about human beings, maybe, that they can squish their language. Because now I'm in the depression and I'm going to need to come up with some good experiences. So I better be able to call this a lot of fun. It'd be a good thing if I were the kind of creature who could call teaching myself piano a lot of fun under these circumstances, right? Do you agree? Yeah.
Is squishing language and attitude the same? Because I feel like you can squish what you're saying, but like her attitude on the piano was, I feel like you're combining those and I thought you said they were different.
That's interesting. Attitude came up as I thought attitude came up earlier in the discussion as a factor that might allow you to avoid being ruined.
But isn't her attitude on the piano, like, that's her attitude which is related to the experience,
good,
not on her language squishing?
It could be that they both go together. It could be that in the next house over, there's some kids who tried the piano thing and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. So it could be that you need both. You're right, those are distinct parts of the problem. But what Laurie and Reba are partly what they're doing is the same thing that my hospice patient is doing in the depression. They're making the best of it. They're saying, well, this is going to be the best, this is the best experience we're having now. People who've lived through the depression really do have, they retain really psychological trauma in many cases from their experience. But yeah, that's a good point. I think attitude is a kind of secondary factor to this. Good. Yeah. Others? What else came out of your groups on this? I think we're giving it a pretty good discussion. I'm pretty happy with where we are. I just want to see if there's something else we can pick up on. We talked about connoisseurship, about bucket lists. I don't know where you guys are, but where I want to leave it is that our desire to pursue peak experiences, complex experiences, richer experiences, isn't an unhealthy impulse, but it isn't strictly necessary. Does that sound plausible? It may be a good strategy for your happiness if your life presents you with those opportunities, but it doesn't follow necessarily that absent those opportunities, you can't legitimately call your life happy, innate.
Well, I think that might also go back to Bob and Mary and help explain maybe why Mary can also be happy and be, in some cases, happier than Bob.
Right. Right.
Because you might not necessarily, like, Bob has the financial security and the lifestyle to be able to go pursue those peak experiences, but Mary is more limited. Mary even might experience more happiness in general.
Yeah. And you got me thinking about how there might be a, you know, Mary might engage in rationalization. She might say, well, I've got these health problems, but I've got good friends. I've got religion in my life. So what's the distinction between a healthy rationalization? I really think there's healthy rationalization where you say, well, you know, this is what my life presents me, right? You know, so I better be happy with this. That is a rationalization. But that's a healthy one in some cases, right? But then what would be an unhealthy rationalization? What would be a case where somebody thought themselves happy because they convinced themselves they were happy, but in fact they could be a lot happier? And say, oh yeah, I'm happy with this. This is good. Yeah.
Like if you're a parent, your kid will get along with you. Be like, oh, me and Jimmy don't get along, but I don't like him anyway. So.
Right. It'd be like a rationalization. It's maybe an unhealthy rationalization to write it off. Yeah. Good. Good. Yeah. Others?
People stay in bad relationships, broken marriages, stay together for kids.
Psychologically abusive relationships, suboptimal relationships where people rationalize, well, you know, at least we're married. You know, yeah, there's lots of unhealthy rationalizations out there, but there's also healthy rationalizations. Okay, so let's leave it there, guys. Have a great weekend. See you guys on Tuesday.